This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za. You're listening to Power Life, Sundays 9 p.m. to midnight on Power 98.7.
So we are speaking to phenomenal women doing amazing things in South Africa and maybe even internationally. Really just, you know, celebrating these women in the industries as they are. And Koketso started her agripreneurship journey in 2012 with breeding of livestock such as sheep, pigs, and planting maize. Subsequently, she would go on to win 2 awards for being a female farmer in maize and sunflower production in the Northwest Province of South Africa. I don't want to give away too much about Koketso because, you know, we want to hear from her herself. Good evening to you, Koketso. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, evening, Toho. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay, I'm fine, thanks. And thank you for the invite.
Great. So let me actually start off before we get into who you are, how you got into farming. Let me start off with what was the highlight of your week or what did you learn this week?
The highlight of my week has to be we just sort of closing off our winter harvest. So normally what we do, we just donate some of our fresh produce to the community where we're based. So we donated 500 bundles of spinach to community members, making sure that every household has. So I think that for me has to be the highlight. And what it taught me is that often what we take for granted in terms of access to food, not something that everybody has, you know, because one of the feedbacks that we got was that someone was like, they literally didn't have anything to eat up until, you know, we came and we did this donation house to house. It just made me realize that we're facing tough times ahead as South Africans, and we really need to help out where we can.
Sure. That is really powerful. That is really great. So let's start off then with your journey into farming. How did that happen?
Yeah, so my journey in farming, it started when my father passed away in 2011. So, you know, it was a tragic passing, and he was already doing farming himself. And I've got, you know, 2 siblings, a younger one and an older one, and none of them were interested in doing farming. At the time, I was working in short-term insurance. Mm. So, you know, I just thought to myself, I don't want to see my dad's legacy, you know, go to nothing. Let me, you know, see what I can do, and let me just give it a shot. So initially I tried to, you know, do that whole part-time farming, you know, farming over the weekends and then working a full-time job. But then at the end of midway through 2012, I was realizing that it's not working. And then towards the end of 2012, I then resigned my job and then I started being in farming full-time.
Okay. But what are some of the, I mean, it couldn't have been easy, you know, resigning at a job that you got, let me say, money every month or so. It couldn't have been easy. What are some of the challenges that you went through in your journey to start being a farmer?
Yeah, it was challenging. I mean, it's a case where when I started doing farming, not many women were in that space. So it was a challenging thing. But and obviously, you know, leaving a job, a well-paying job and everything wasn't easy, but I started out with that vision to say, look, this is what I want to build in the farm, and I want to make this operation become commercial. So it wasn't easy. It was challenging. It was difficult to walk away from my career, but at the same time, I felt that, no, I need to at least give this a shot. And then if it doesn't work out, I can always go back to my career. Mm. But so far, I'm still here. So it's working out and I'm enjoying farming. I'm enjoying the agricultural sector. I'm enjoying basically being in the business of food production and ensuring that the country has food security. I'm enjoying it. It's a very challenging journey, but it's also one that is very fulfilling.
Mm. What is a typical day like for you?
Typically, normally, like what happens that through the various things, because I've got different operations. I've got an operation where we do like field crops. So we'll do like your maize, your sunflower, your soybean. And that sort of occupies my time, usually from October up until June. And then I've got an operation where it's a vegetable operation, which is a day-to-day thing where literally every day you are busy with, you know, planting, harvesting, you're busy with, you know, tending the fresh produce plants and stuff. And then I've also got a livestock operation. So it just juggles between the three, and our busiest time typically is usually over the summer period, where because, you know, it's summertime, we can plant a variety of crops. So we usually activate all of our product lines over the summertime, and we are planting. We're very, very busy from the September period right up until like the June, the May-June period. So it just depends, like, which season it is. But, it just involves, you know, early mornings, late nights in the summer. Winter time is usually a bit of a slower time. Just if you have a great team of people that you're working with, who you've trained up well, who they understand the job, and everybody understands their role and understands the deliverables, it makes it easier working in that type of environment. So initially, when I was setting up everything on the fresh produce side, it was quite demanding because I had to train up my team. You know, I had to set minimum standards of quality and deliverables. And now, you know, I think this is our third year. We're basically going in the fresh produce space, and things are easier. You know, my staff is trained up. They're very competent. They know, you know, what to deliver. So I don't have to be as hands-on as I used to be, although obviously I'm still hands-on in terms of managing the operations. But it's more of a case where you can delegate more because now you know that, look, my people are competent and they know what to do and they're reliable. So it becomes easier, you know, as you put your systems in place in terms of managing your day-to-day operations.
The issue, Kogezo, you know, you went into farming, and as you said yourself as well, is that it is not a lot of women are in farming. You know, how were you received by your male counterparts?
Well, initially when I started, I mean, I think some people were very skeptical, like, this girl's just here for just, you know, it's a fly by night. She's only here for like a year or 2 years. She's going to go. And a lot of people were skeptical, but I knew that, look, I'm here forever. So I stuck with it, even though it was difficult and challenging at first. But, you know, on the plus side, I mean, farmers are very welcoming as people. They're very, you know, open, and they're very, they're those type of people who are so into, like, knowledge sharing, you know, and sharing information, sharing best practices, you know, welcoming you onto their farms and so on. So coming from that perspective, I was able to, you know, throughout my journey, to meet really great, like, mentors, you know, and people who I could tap into and, you know, request help and ask for help, and help in the form of, you know, information, trying to learn, trying to understand the best practice, trying to understand the systems. And they were more than willing to assist me and help me, you know. And also you as a farmer also have to be that person that you have to, you know, not want to be spoon-fed as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so you also have to show, like, a lot of initiative on your side to actually seek for knowledge and, you know, constantly take yourself for courses and training and so on, so that as much as people are helping you, but you also need to be very proactive in terms of looking for knowledge, seeking knowledge, and, you know, like, finding, researching, you know, whatever you're going to do, and getting familiar with it and so on. Then if people can also see that, look, this person is also willing to really put their heart and soul into it, then more people will actually be willing to help you. You know, but if you're also sort of like very, like, let's say, and you sort of don't really, you know, you wait for people to spoon feed you, then they also become disheartened. But if you're a person who sort of, you know, pushes knowledge, and you also show that you are passionate, because ultimately, like any other industry, you must have, like, a passion for what you're doing. Mm. You must want to know. You must want to figure it out and understand it and understand, like, the intricacies and, you know, the things that make it up, and understand the fine detail. Pay attention to the fine detail and attention. So if people see you doing that consistently, then they will be more available to help you.
Now, you speak about your team, you know, the team that you have on your farm. And I remember being there and you just kind of speak to them about, okay, guys, let's do this, let's do that. But how did you find your team? I mean, it must have been something quite tiresome as well to be able to find people that, one, you can trust, but also people that are willing to learn and work.
Yeah, I think, you know, how I found my team, like most entrepreneurs, in the beginning, I saw like a lot of flames, you know, in the sense that I had people who were working for me who then were not reliable, and then some of them absconded and so on, and I just had all that drama. But you know, they kind of came through organically. I mean, the person who's my farm supervisor now approached, you know, me and my partner and said, look, I want to work for you guys. And it was a case where, you know, he started working for us, but at the time he wasn't the supervisor. And slowly but surely, then I recruited my other people. And, you know, you just build it up organically. And it's there's no perfect formula to it, but basically it's just about people gelling together, but also people having good communication amongst themselves, and also having respect, because, you know, in the team, people work well if they respect each other. So I think, you know, it's one of those things that you sort of grew it organically and gradually over time. And so far, I'd say we're like in a good place because we understand each other. I mean, I'm employing eight permanent people on a permanent basis, and then I employ additional seasonal workers, sometimes up to like 20 people, depending on the extent of the harvest, as seasonal workers. So, but so far, like it's not something that I'd say there's a formula for you to put together a team. But what I'd say is that you know, you need to sort of be straight with your people in terms of what your expectations are, and also take time to train them, because I think often sometimes people give up too easily on people in terms of trying to train them and trying to, you know, make them understand your vision and, you know, the plan that you have for the farm. So often, a lot of the time, if people are not understanding from the get-go, you get tired, and then you immediately want to fire the people and so on. And sometimes you give up on people too easily. So what I'd say to entrepreneurs is don't give up on people too easily. Take time to train them up. Take time to, you know, to workshop them and really, you know, let them buy into your vision and also understand what needs to be done, where you guys are going. And I think through that, through those open communication channels, you know, respecting even your workers, because even how you treat your workers is important, you know. If you respect your workers and you give them that respect as employees, and they also give you that respect, then it becomes a healthy work environment. But if you're going to, you know, treat your people badly and call them names and all those type of things, you can't do that, because it's self-sabotaging. It just breeds toxicity and, you know, like bad vibes in the work environment. So I think how you treat your workers and how you relate to them, and it's very, very important. And that's actually one of the key things that will either make you a successful farm or like a failed farm.
How you treat your workers is very important. Now, you've then found your team, and now you must train them. What processes did you take, or what methods did you take to actually train the team that you have now?
I think in terms of my methods, I mean, when we first started, I trained them myself. But as time went on, then I would get on other people who are our suppliers to come and give us, you know, workshops on site, on the farm. So I would get like our seed suppliers to come and give us workshops for the day. I would get our fertilizer guys to come do the same thing, our chemical suppliers to come and train us. And then this year, we've just shifted it slightly. We now do off-site training. So we've done off-site chemical training on, you know, learning different pesticides and different herbicides. And then we go. So basically, it's just continuous training and, you know, keeping people on their feet, keeping people understanding what the best practice is and where things are moving. So I believe in that. Like, I believe also just in continuous learning and continuously upskilling yourself. So even with my staff, it's the same way, like we will always have people either come on site or we go outside to do training so that we make sure that our knowledge always remains fresh and relevant.
Is this something that you would have anyway gone into despite, you know, your dad's passing? Is it something that you think you definitely would have done anyway?
I don't think so. Hey, it's weird to think of it in that way because it's like I often just refer to myself. I think when you came, I told you, I refer to myself as an accidental farmer.
Yeah.
Because I almost fell into what I was always supposed to do, if you could always put it like that, where, you know, even though I was working in short-term insurance, I always felt this need, like, you know, if ever I could ever go back and work in my home province, which is the Northwest, and be there and be situated there. But I don't know what would actually bring me there permanently. But it was obviously farming. So it wasn't something that I ever envisioned myself doing because I'm one of those very, very girly, girly type of people. So it was like I would never have envisioned it for myself. But being in it, and I realized that, look, even if you are, you don't think your personality is matched to it, it's one of those things that actually you learn a lot and you can bring your own strength to it. So, yeah, I didn't ever imagine I would actually do farming or agriculture, but I do find that being in it, I enjoy the art of growing things. You know, I enjoy the art of food production, you know, because without farmers, you always hear that thing, without farmers, there's no food. I enjoy the role that as farmers we play in terms of feeding people and ensuring that we provide food security for the country, you know, which is so important because without food security in a country will become unstable. So I think just like, you know, the gravity of the work that I think that we play as farmers, it's such an important fiction society. So I almost now, you know, feel that it's a calling for me. Like I was always meant to be in the space and occupy it. Although initially at first it wasn't like I envisioned it, you know, but now that I'm sort of in the space and I've been in the space for it's 11 years now, I can't imagine my life doing anything else, wow. You know,
wow.
besides being in the agricultural sector.
Sure. So what have you learned about yourself in these 11 years of you being a farmer?
What I've learned about myself, that I'm very resilient. I'm an adaptable person. So you can throw me into the deep end and I'll figure out how to swim. I'm a hard worker because hard farming, you know, needs a person who's a hard worker. Can't be a lazy farmer. Like there's no such. I'm a person who is very passionate also about, like, you know, the rural economy and the role that the rural economy can play in terms of, you know, taking South Africa forward, because not everybody can move to the urban areas. You know, the rural economy can play a bigger role than it's actually playing now, and it can contribute more to the country's GDP. So I've learned like a lot about myself in the sense that I'm a go-getter personality. I'm a visionary, you know. So when I say I want to do something, I just need a couple of months or years to execute it, and then eventually I can stay the course and then I make sure that I see it through. So just that resilience, that persistence as a person. And I think it helps me because it makes me well suited for agriculture, because with agriculture, like any other industry, there's times when things just go pear-shaped and things don't go your way. You have setbacks, you have challenges, so if you are a person who's a dogged personality, then you can be able to weather any storm that comes your way.
Was there anything that you found you had to change about yourself going into farming?
Yeah, I'd say that maybe, what did I have to change about myself? I would say maybe if I think about how I was in terms of doubting myself a lot when I was maybe, you know, working a 9-to-5 job and so on. in terms of, you know, making a decision and being steadfast in it. Whereas in farming, you don't actually have that luxury. Like, you either need to choose between A or B, and you need to make decisions, like, lightning fast. So I found I needed to learn how to be more decisive, which I've become a more decisive person because of farming. Because you have to make a decision, you know, and you make a decision whether good or bad, and then you live with the consequences, you know. And sometimes things work out your way, you make the right decision, and it's, you know, happy all around and it's good vibes all around. And sometimes you make a decision and things become disastrous. But even if the decision is bad, you then have to pick up the pieces of that decision and the consequence of that decision and keep it moving. So, I think it's made me more of a decisive person.
How was the hard lockdown for you as farmers, but for you specifically?
I mean, for me, it was interesting because when I started with the fresh produce unit, as I said to you, I was doing 3 units before. So when I started with the fresh produce unit, we literally started when lockdown began. And it was interesting. It was challenging because it was a case where I didn't even know what to expect in this fresh produce industry. And fresh produce farmers actually, during hard lockdowns, were going through like the worst moments ever, because it was a case where markets were not as busy as they were and informal traders couldn't trade. And informal traders, in terms of the fresh produce space, are actually like the lifeblood of that industry. So when informal traders couldn't trade and they couldn't get access to product and so on, a lot of farmers actually had to waste like their fresh produce, you know. So I was actually one of them, where we had planted and we had all this fresh produce, but the market couldn't absorb all of the fresh produce we had produced. But instead of wasting it, we just donated it. So we just donated it to the households, to the villages, like the surrounding villages of ours. And we made sure that we donate all of it, because it was a case where we know as South Africans that during hard lockdown, a lot of families were going through a very difficult time. You know, people were losing their jobs, people were losing their incomes. It was a very, very challenging time. So we just were, on our side, donating a lot of our fresh produce. And it was a challenging time. It was a challenging time, but, you know, as things began to open up and then we went from level 5 to level 4 and to the other various levels, then things began to open up. So I'd say now, with everything how it is, like, obviously everything's opened up, all the restrictions have been removed. Things are basically back to normal, but there's all of these other compounding factors also still coming from the lockdown, where the reality is that we still have people who lost their jobs, some never got rehired. So it's affected how things were in terms of people's purchasing power, people's buying power. So we're more dealing with that now. But to be honest, for the fact that we made it through the hard lockdown was just a blessing. You know, to say we made it through, it was difficult, but we made it through with our health, you know, with our families intact. Not everybody was as fortunate. So I think it's just also readjusting one's like gaze to gain perspective on it and to say, you know, it might have been tough financially, it might have been challenging, but you know what, at least we got to, you know, make it through with our health and our families intact. So you just thank God for that. I mean, you know, as farmers, we're very spiritual people on the whole, because you can't spend R1 million putting seed in the ground and not believe in a higher power, because if God doesn't make it rain, then guess what? Like, no matter whatever you've done, you have done all the right steps, plowed your fields, done all the stuff. But if God doesn't bring the rain down for you to have a successful season, nothing happens. So I think for me, what the lockdown, what it did is that it just deepened my spirituality, it deepened, you know, like my faith in God, it deepened. And for a lot of farmers, it did that, hey, because it was really, really tough for a lot of people. But I think for the fact that as a sector we've pulled through, you know, we should sort of give ourselves a pat on the back. And it just proves once again, like, it's a testament, you know, to how resilient and how we came together. Because we came together, a lot of us were sharing our experiences about what we were going through, and we were assisting each other. So that's also when I could see that, no, I'm definitely with the right people here, because you're with, you know, you're in a sector where people care for each other, people help each other out. So from that perspective, it was a good a feeling, because it was like, through this difficulty and adversity, people are coming together and they're bonding together. So, you know, it showed the good side of humanity from that perspective.
Sure. 0861-987-000. That's the number that you can dial if you'd like to speak to Koketso Moloko. She's a farmer and agripreneur, and, you know, just speaking everything around farming, what she's learned, the difficulties that she had to go through, the challenges, really. But we'll also speak to some of what was rewarding for Koketso. Let's start with a conversation from Steve, a call from Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good evening, Toronto. I wanted actually to ask Koketso. I'm sure she is from Mahalis, if my memory serves me well. I wanted to find out, is there any intention actually to add on the farming basket, the bee farming? Because the reason I'm actually asking is that I'm asking this is because the type of business that I'm using, natural honey, not adulterated honey. Sometimes they call it raw honey, and sometimes they call it pure honey. But now I prefer to call it natural honey. That's the honey that I'm actually using. And I'm not using adulterated honey. The one that you normally get in the supermarket, where it looks like it is liquid. No, that one is not working. So I wanted to find out if she has in any way intention to can go into to add bee farming into farming basket.
Okay. Thank you for that, Stephen in Pretoria West. Koketso?
Yes, yeah. Look, to answer Stephen, I actually took a beekeeping course. So adding beehives, particularly like to the sunflower side, because if you're going to be doing sunflower farming, beehives go really, really well with it. So adding beehives to my sunflower operation has been something that I've been wanting to do. It's very, very interesting, because when you take a beekeeping course, you learn so much actually about the role that bees play, obviously in pollination of crops, but just the importance of bees, you know. I've taken a beekeeping course, so hopefully in the future I'll be starting with it, and it will be something that I can add onto my business.
All right. Well, definitely something that we'll be looking forward to see you in that industry as well, in the bee farming world. But, you know, you speak about how COVID-19 really showed you that farmers are standing together. Does this then mean that everybody is aware that they all can have a piece of the pie?
Yeah, I think the reality is that, you know, with COVID-19, it humbled a lot of people, because, you know, people were either in their comfort zones in terms of just like how life goes, and, you know, they just were sort of going along with things. But because it humbled so many people, because it was literally like everyone was forced to stop and reflect and stop and check what they're doing in their businesses, in their personal lives, in everything. I think it just brought about a lot of perspective. And it also just brought about, you know, people assisting other people, because, you know, you then saw that it's not, you know, I'm not really by myself as a person. And, you know, I can't sort of just be about myself. I need to also help other people. And then in turn, they'll also help me as well. So I think it was a humbling experience, and a very, I'd say, vulnerable, very volatile time for a lot of people. And if, a time where people, you know, who often, you know, tout themselves as being strong, some were falling apart, you know, others who were weak were finding strength that they never knew they had. So it was a very, very difficult time, but, you know, in a time where it was like an emotional roller coaster for a lot of people, in terms of everything they were going through, their businesses, their relationships and so on. But I think, you know, we were put through that for a reason. I'm always one of those people that believe we go through difficulty for a reason. So, you know, having looked at it, and looked at even some of the positives, because obviously a lot of negatives came out of it. But even some positives in terms of, you know, how human beings can be and how human beings can rally together in a time of crisis. I think for me, that's what I took as a positive sign.
And of course, then have you, I mean, you speak about, you know, the help that you each gave each other somehow, but what's the assistance like from government?
It's, you know, to be quite honest, I think government, like, I really feel that they need to change the type of model that they employ when it comes to assisting farmers, because typically what happens is that it's always assistance via the department, but often what happens is that, you know, it gets put out, whatever process happens gets put out to tender, and then some of these tenders are very inflated and so on. So I really think what they need to do, those resources that they're making available as government, they need to find a way to partner up with, you know, the private sector, because a lot of farmers already use specific private sector companies to source their goods. So instead of you know, putting this thing out to tender, rather take that, I don't know, 20 million or that 100 million that's made available for farmers, give it to a company like Obaro or NWK, and then let farmers actually go collect their inputs from that company, you know, as opposed to now putting in a middleman, and then we get, you know, inflated invoices, inflated things, and we don't really get value for money from the tender system. Because, you know, what will often happen with these government tenders, just to give an example, is that someone can, like, you can do, maybe you can put in a, install a shade net, which is a 1 hectare shade net for 600,000, okay, let's say. And then now with the tender system, someone will come and make and install it for, and say they'll install it for 900,000 as opposed to 600,000. Whereas if they could just take that money, that 600,000, pay it to the shade net company, then you as a farmer get your shade net. You'll almost be getting more bang for your buck, you know? So I think there's a need to reimagine how money is dispersed and reimagine who it's dispersed to, and make sure that the farmer gets value, because the issue for me is, like, if you're going to take out R1 million, let that farmer get that entire R1 million value. Don't then diminish the value by adding a middleman, and then the farmer only maybe gets value to the tune of like 300,000 or 400,000. So I think they need to really look at public-private partnerships as a matter of urgency. And they need to also let farmers drive the process. I mean, farmers know where they source the materials from, where they get these things. So a lot of the time, they'll go tell you as a farmer, go source your materials out of province or at this other supplier that you've never used. And then that person doesn't necessarily have the right things or products or materials. So it's just a need of, you know, people need to involve farmers more in the planning of these things. And then they need to look at a public-private partnership. I think with that, then you'll start to see these you know, the programs that government has finding more traction, you know, and having more traction, because people will be able to source that from the suppliers.
And I mean, it really can't be that difficult, right, for there to be some kind of conversation between farmers and the department for things to be easier and smoother for both parties.
Yeah, I can't. It's not difficult, you know. I just think it's one of those things that we need to look at this tender system, because now it's been what, more than 28 years now. So we need to look at this tender system and look at the various places where this tender system is not working, you know, and not giving the value for money that it has promised to give, you know. And if it's not doing that, then we need to say, okay, how do we then reopen the private sector? Because these people who are in the private sector already have the companies that are doing this thing on a daily basis and are supplying these things and have the relationships with actual farmers. Because a lot of the time, you know, you try to find government, try to almost reinvent the wheel by going out and looking at who is a farmer, prove that you're a farmer so we don't get a dodgy person into this process. But if you go and deal directly with the private sector, say, private sector, who are the farmers that you guys are already dealing with, who are already buying from you? You know, how do we support those people? Because obviously the farmers are already buying from these private sector companies and sourcing from them. Then there are legitimate farmers. They actually have farms that exist. You know, so already that takes away a whole unnecessary layer of like vetting. And then you just simply supply those private companies with the money for them to be able to have those farmers collect either the animal feed that they need for their animals, the animal medicines that they need, you know, the input that they need for their maize, like, you know, the seeds, the fertilizers, the chemicals, you know, the diesel directly from these people. So I think there's a need to really look at how is the money that is being dispersed and spent. Is there value for money that's been gotten by the various government officials? If there isn't value for money, how do we then reset the system in such a way that we make it that there's value for money for farmers, and also that the department literally gets traction in terms of the programs that they have? You know, where if they're able to disperse 50 million rand, then they're able to literally use that whole money, that entire money, to help farmers. And none of it gets lost in the value chain in terms of unnecessary middlemen and all those things, you know?
Mm-hmm. What would your advice then be to a woman that is listening to you now and actually wants to perhaps start with being a farmer or go into the farming industry?
Yeah, my advice to them would be, firstly, research as to which sector you want to go into, because obviously, you know, agriculture is very diverse. So there's like either you're in the side of the animals, or you're in the side of the crop, or, you know, you're in different parts. I mean, there's even, you know, people who are the suppliers who supply like the various inputs that farmers need. So there's different parts of the agricultural value chain, you know, that people can be involved in. Others are into the agro-processing part of it, where you take the primary good, you know, you beneficiate it, you add value to it, and then you sell it. So what I'd say is, first look at what part of the value chain you want to be a player in there. And then from there, research that well. And from there, then start. If you have access to land, either that you are renting or communal land somewhere in your tribal authority, because most African people come from tribal authorities, come from the rural areas, you know. So try to see if you can either access land via your tribal authority, communal land, or try to see if you can either maybe rent land or get access to land. And then from there, you are able to then start, you know. But what I would also say to them is that this whole, you know, fallacy that you don't need money to start is also not true, because there is some level of seed capital that you're going to need as a farmer to get things started and to kick things off. So you need to realistically look at that seed capital to start anything. So you need to look at the seed capital that you would need to start your operation off, and exactly what type of operation you want to start. And also, ideally, if you can, try to reach out. If you're in an area where really you've got access to land, just look around as to who are your local farmers and try to see if you can get one of them to mentor you or just give you advice. You know, go onto their farm, ask to see their operation, ask if you can ask questions. That thing will also help you in the end, because, you know, once you're able to sort of go onto their site, you then get a feel of what is it like being on a farm. Is this really something that I want to do? You know, if so, how do I go about doing it? And then you just start researching. But I would say to people, as much as farmers, we're having a very difficult time, because, you know, we've got rising commodity prices, we've got rising input prices and everything. And it's a very tough time now in the sector. But what I would say is that people shouldn't give up on farming. People shouldn't give up on getting into the sector. And it's a challenging sector, I won't lie, but it's a sector that is worthwhile to get into. And it's a sector that is you won't regret getting into it, in the sense that you are doing what I think is such a great service to humanity in terms of supplying food and feeding the nation. So just do your research. But I would really encourage people to keep on getting into the sector and keep on coming into it, and, you know, partnering up if needs be. But don't be discouraged, because like any other sector, it does have the difficulties, it does have the challenges. But don't ever listen to people tell you, no, don't get into this, the waste of time. Just know which part of the value chain you want to get into, and then go for it. Because I also believe that you're not going to know everything before you start farming. So, you know, also trust in your ability to learn as you're going in the sector and as you're growing in the sector.
Mm. In conversation with Koketso Moloko, a farmer and agripreneur, we'll continue this conversation with her as we then delve into other issues that, you know, Koketso was extremely vocal about what's taking place currently in the country. And we'll then have that conversation with her on other issues beyond farming.
You're listening to Power Life, Sundays 9 p.m. to midnight on Power 98.7.
This is indeed Power Life. It is 19 minutes after 10. Let's continue our conversation with farmer and agripreneur Koketso Moloko. Koketso, so, I mean, you are very vocal about what happens in the country on social media, you know, and you're vocal on social media about what happens in the country. And we've seen protest upon protest once again of women that have been raped and communities standing up against what has taken place in Kagiso. So this is just one of the examples I can give of gender-based violence that has once again wreaked havoc in the country. What is your take on what has taken place there and the response from government?
So from my side, you know, it's just been very, like, disheartening, and my heart goes out to those ladies that were violated like that, you know. And just the role of just government and not listening to people and not listening to when they complain and when they cry out. I think that's what this Kagiso, you know, situation has highlighted for us, amongst others, because you've got Kagiso, you've got the service delivery protest that we saw in Tembisa, where people also sadly lost their lives. So I think, you know, we just getting to a point where you just have a government that's very mute to listening to people, and doesn't really take into account what is it that people want and what is it that communities want. So it's just been very, very sad from that perspective, you know, and also just listening to the various stories of the people who've been violated, you know, by these, you know, illegal miners, and, you know, how the community has basically been under siege. But, you know, no one has cared to listen. Cops have been indifferent. You know, some of them have been on the take from these people. They've been getting money from them. So they just turned a blind eye on it. And I think what we're having now is actually a complete breakdown of law and order in society, you know, where you can just see across provinces, a lot of things unraveling. And they are unraveling at such a fast pace, you know. And we need to just ask ourselves to say, you know, why is it unraveling? Who is benefiting from the dysfunction of the society? You know, who's benefiting from the fact that things are so dysfunctional, like this whole Zama-Zama thing as well? I mean, these Zama-Zamas are the ones who are at the bottom of the chain, you know, in terms of, you know, that gold, because you can see that this is highly organized, highly syndicated. And the question then is like, where is this gold going to? Because these people are digging up this gold. It's not, they're not digging it up for fun. They're digging it up because it's going somewhere. It's, you know, being flown out of the country. There's been, you know, illicit smuggling and all those type of things at hand. And you can tell that this thing goes all the way to the top, in the sense that, you know, I often say to people, because, you know, from my perspective, I'm a farmer. So one of our biggest problems that we have is like stock theft. So I always say to people to say, if a farmer loses like 100 cattle in one night, let's just apply our minds to say, who's got that level of infrastructure to remove 100 cattle from a farmer's farm? You know, it has to be someone with, you know, huge, huge trucks and trailers taking about, you know, 50 cattle at a time, you know, those trailers where you see those massive, massive trailers. So that often, that will then tell you to say, no, then it can't be that it's likely that it's our people who are the African people, are maybe the people that will take that cattle and will put it in the corner there for that truck to come and collect it. But the person who owns the truck, you know, that's going to take that cattle and take it onto someone's farm, or take it onto, you know, take it to the abattoir to go get slaughtered. So I think when it comes to the way crime is just perpetrated in this country, we need to think deeper about it, and we need to keep on looking deeper and saying, it can't just be that it's the people who are doing this thing at the bottom. It has to be the fact that, you know, when someone even hijacks your bikie as a farmer, where are these bikie parts going to? You know, who has that network to be able to move those parts, you know? So It's a lot of the people that I think we think are good actors in terms of, oh, they don't do crime, or it's a certain type of, you know, race that does crime, or a certain type of people that do crime. These other ones don't do crime. We need to rethink that paradigm, and we need to start looking to say, look, this thing goes all the way to the top in terms of who are the kingpins, who are the masterminds, who are the syndicates, because we are seeing the lower level crime, but someone is benefiting from the dysfunction.
And we do know as well, I mean, just linking it up with these illegal miners, the minister, Bekicele, police minister, saying yesterday that there's definitely some kind of human trafficking that is taking place because some of the people that were arrested were very young. But then in the same breath, we are seeing Minister Aaron Motsoaledi for Home Affairs, we are seeing him really, you know, trying to clamp down on these illegal entrances or illegal foreigners entering the country in their own way. Do you think any of this will make some kind of a difference?
I think it will, because, you know, if you look at it from the Minister Motsoaledi's point of view, he was a lone voice at one point. You know, he was the one who was speaking out about this thing, saying, when we call for proper border control and the proper movement of people, we are not being xenophobic when we call for this. You know, we are simply asking that everyone who's within the borders, can we know who that person is? Can we have that person documented in some way or another so that there's law and order in the country? And Minister Motsoaledi, for a very long time, he was a lone minister calling for this thing, and he was labeled by some ministers as being xenophobic. You know, some people were distancing himself from his utterances. But as things are starting to unravel, as we keep on going, people are now also raising their voices about what he's been talking about for basically the past year, you know. And I think, he's on the right direction. He's right. But one thing we need to also remember is that even the type of governance that we have in South Africa, we need to look after 28 years. That is it the right system? Because, you know, we've got the ministers, they sit at the national level, they're planning policy, they're planning, things which obviously affect things on the ground. But we then have, you know, provincial government being there, and then we also have the municipalities and the district municipalities there. So all of this, you know, layers that we have, these three layers of government that we have, we need to seriously look at how do they speak to each other? How do they coordinate things amongst each other? Is it necessarily the best system to have? Because perhaps maybe we could just only have like one implementation system, which is either we have provincial or we have municipality or we have the districts. But to have like three sort of different layers in terms of the people that must implement, I think if you try to sort of trace a lot of the complex messes, one can put it that way, that happen in South Africa, it comes in the implementation policies. I mean, you often hear people say, in South Africa, we're so good at planning and, you know, having the best laid plans. But when it comes to implementing, we're all over the show. And it's easy to understand why we're all over the show, because when you have three different people who are tasked with implementing, you've got the province, you've got, you know, the municipality, you've got the district. Amongst the three of them, there's finger pointing, you know, in terms of who must do what and who needs to build this house, who needs to. So imagine if maybe those three people could be consolidated into one, where everybody knows there's just only province that's in charge of implementing. There's no district, there's no municipalities. It's all consolidated into one. And we know where the buck stops in terms of, you know, an implementation agent and, you know, who accountability rests with. I think if South Africans could have that, then we'd be more at peace, because currently now the type of system of governance that we have, the implementation part is where a lot of people are being failed, you know, and it's where a lot of people are escaping accountability, because the person will say, look, I'm an MMC, I'm not the MEC, or, you know, I'm not this person at the district. Speak to this person. So people just keep on being just shoved from pillar to post in terms of trying to find accountability for basic things that should be delivered to them. So I think this is also where a lot of the problems start in our society.
And what would you then say to your younger self?
in terms of what my life, how it turned out.
Yeah, in terms of your life and work.
Yeah, I think to my younger self, I'd say, it's been an interesting ride so far. It's one of those things that obviously when you're younger, you've got these other plans for your life and how things are going to turn out and so on. But I think it's just been interesting in the sense that I realized that, in life you can plan for your life to go a certain way, but it's not necessarily going to go according to what you plan. But I'm a strong believer a lot of the time in the fact that in life, you're always where you're supposed to be. So, to my younger self, I'd say enjoy the ride, keep on rolling with the punches, keep on enjoying the journey, and just keep an open mind to things, because things always have a strange way of turning and going. But sometimes it's actually to your benefit, in the end. Yeah.
All right. And what then would you say it means for you to be a woman in South Africa now?
To be honest, to be a woman in South Africa now, I just have very mixed emotions. I think particularly just with everything that's just going on, the rapes, the murders, the femicides, it feels very strange because it's a feeling where we live in a democracy where, we've got all these rules, we've got all these laws that are there to protect women and, ensure equality for them and so on. And where we don't have our laws oppressing us. I mean, when you look at countries like America, where they're having back things like roll back, like abortion rights and so on, and they're still, fighting over a woman's body and so on. We as a society have progressed way past that point. And, we, like South Africans, take certain liberties for granted. It's a very strange feeling, I have to say, because as I said to you, it's just like, I think depending on even your socioeconomic class, it also depends on the type of experience that you have as a woman in South Africa, because you think about the danger that some women who don't have access to cars, who have to walk late at night or in the early hours of the morning. Right now we're in the middle of winter, it's still very dark in the morning. Some women have to start walking from 5 a.m., 6 a.m. to work in the morning in the dark. And those people are often prey to, people who are going to rape and people who are going to do muggings and all types of criminality. So I think, the number one thing that we need to look at is ensuring that there's a safe society for women. I know, we often hear politicians say that the difficulty about these femicide things is that it happens between people who are, partners, husband, wife, or partners and so on. So it's difficult to police. But I think, for me, what would speak to that is that we then need harsher laws and sentences, because, I think minimum mandatory sentencing would actually be a strong deterrent. If someone knows that, look, if I kill my partner and I get convicted, I am facing actual life in prison without a possibility of parole. Mm-hmm. I honestly feel that we will start to see this, wanton killing and this just people just doing crazy things. We'll start to see a decline because people will actually start to understand the gravity of taking a life, taking a human life, what that actually means, to rape someone, to kill someone, even mugging, something like mugging. If there's a minimum mandatory sentence that one can face, you will think twice before you mug someone or do things like housebreaking. Because the reality is that nowadays people are not safe, you can be at home sitting in your house, someone can just jump the gate and break in, and then I was reading a tweet earlier on, I think, and it just traumatized me so much from Heidi Jokos, where she said, she was caught in a situation like that where they broke into the house and came into a space and she thought she was going to be raped. And it's like, why should anyone in this country have to go through that feeling? How is this okay? So I really feel that we need to look at minimum mandatory sentencing. And I squarely put blame at the doorstep of our parliamentarians, because we have endless indabas, we have endless talk shops that go to nowhere. But the people who actually have it in their power to legislate these things and change the law and overhaul the law, you know, don't do it. You know, they don't do it. Instead, we still keep on going on with the same laws, and we can see that this thing of criminality, you know, just the society that's literally falling apart, it's getting worse. But we don't see, you know, our parliamentarians responding effectively to actually change the laws and make them harsh so that people think twice before raping, killing, you know, doing housebreakings. Like, people need to think twice. So our parliamentarians, I think, are to blame. And for some strange reason, when people talk, we always blame everybody else. We blame, you know, politicians. We blame, but the people who we should actually be blaming is parliamentarians, because they are the people that have the power that's vested in them to change the laws of the country, to at least curb these type of crimes from happening. Because if something has happened, there's nothing we can do about something that's happened, you know. But we can do certain things to stop future things from happening. And I really believe that if we look at our legislation properly and we start to look at how do we make it harsher for people who are convicted of such crimes, you know. I mean, we don't have to bring things back like the death penalty, but at least life without parole for serious and violent crimes, something that we should consider.
Koketso Mologwa, farmer and agripreneur, thank you so much for your time this evening and for really just allowing us into your space to hear more about the work that you do and your thoughts on what's happening in the country.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Toho. I really appreciate it.
Always great speaking to Koketso, you know, such a breath of fresh air. That's how you put it, right? But thank you so much to Koketso. 0861-987-000. Remember, that's the number that you can dial. Or tweet us at PowerFM987, at @Tsogomoagi_.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.